Good evening. This is Bob Willard. The program is Profiles, and this is our opportunity to visit with those people that come to South Central Indiana who are, make a difference. Our guest this evening is composer Joan Tower. I should say composer, pianist, and now conductor Joan Tower. Joan's work has been performed by the St. Louis, New York, San Francisco, Minneapolis, Dallas, Chicago, Kansas City, Toronto orchestras, and the National Symphony, the London Philharmonic, the Berlin Radio Orchestra, and numerous chamber ensembles, trios, quartets, and soloists. Her composition, Fanfare for the Uncommon Woman, has been performed by more than 200 different ensembles. She is the first woman to win the biggest prize in contemporary music, the Grawemeyer Award. She is also, now as we said, a conductor and a professor of music at Bard College, and in May of 1998 was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. And she's with us today, so thank you, Joan, for visiting. It seems that in the last, shall we say, 20 years, women in music have achieved new positions of prominence. Besides your success, there's Ellen Zwillich, Libby Larson, and others as composers, and now two of our largest orchestras have female music directors, Marin Alsop in Colorado and Joanne Folletta in Buffalo. Before that, there was Sarah Caldwell, Antonio Brico, and frankly, I can't think of any female composers of classical music, except going all the way back to Ruth Crawford Seeger. And so what happened?
Well, you forgot Hildegard von Bingham.
Well, that's
who
way
goes
back.
Way back. Yeah. She has about 15 CDs out now, I think. I'm so happy that that's happened.
Okay.
I really am because it. I mean, I'm so happy that she is getting so much visibility in terms of recordings and performances. Hildegard, because it sort of says to people, well, if she was in the Middle Ages, there must have been some people since then. And there are, in fact, people since then. And I think it's only within the last 15 years that the musicologists have started to really dig in and try to find this music from the Renaissance, Baroque, and classical and romantic eras. And so now we have biographies of women that deserve them, like Clara Schumann, Amy Beach, Ruth Crawford Seeger. And we have now we have a dictionary of
yes, the New Groves.
Yeah,
yes.
Norton. No, it's Norton.
Norton. Okay,
it's a phenomenal dictionary of women musicians, and we have now the music is starting to be published. Therefore, it can be performed. So all of this is very very exciting, and it's all within the last 15, 20 years.
But do you feel that you started this or had anything to do with it or just sort of coincidence?
Well, I think the musicologists play a huge role in this because the education, you grow up reading the books. You know, I was at Columbia for 14 years and I read, you know, a lot of the major histories of music. And I never read about women. Never. This was in the 60s and 70s. The books hadn't come out yet about women for my generation. I mean, for me growing up as a student. Now you start to read about them, hear about them, hear them perform. So that's very exciting right now for
but
me.
Talent does allow your music to get performed. But I noticed you started your own group, what, the DiCapo group?
Yeah. When I came up, I wasn't going to wait around for anything. So I, because for one thing, I have trouble with rejection. I don't like to send
things. Well,
you're
so unusual.
I mean, I'm really unusual in this respect. I don't like to send things out and have them come back, you know, like we're not interested type thing. So I formed my own group and because I was a pianist and I wanted to keep playing and I was a composer, but less so of a composer. And I thought, well, maybe I would hear a piece once or twice a year. So that's actually, that was the best thing I could have done at that time because it put me in a creative position immediately of working with players on a regular basis and of working with other composers because we played other composers on a regular basis. And it was an incredible education for me.
In what way?
In the sense of learning how to to deal with the whole concept of how does a piece come off the page. You know, being a composer, you unless you're an improviser, you write it down, right? And that whole process of how does it come out on the other side via the performers is very intricate. You have to understand how the translation of this blueprint is going to come out in reality of sound, and how the players view that. How do they hear that? How do they interpret that? How does that roadmap become something meaningful to them?
It gives you an opportunity to hear what the technical difficulties or lack of, or what you what instruments can do that you may not be aware of, too, wouldn't it?
That and how they think about it and how they talk about it and how players work together, how they work on music, all of that. Very educational.
Well, does it ever bother you to be identified as a female composer rather than just as a composer without the word, without the gender attached?
Well, you know, I must be a kind of a maverick in this sense. I don't have any problems with that at all. I know some of my colleagues do. And it always interests me that they're very sensitive to it. I think of it as like another description, you know, like you're from Utah or you're from – or you're a banker or you're a – you grew up in Asia. It, to me, it's just a description. But a lot of people don't view it that way. They view it very – it's kind of like a trigger point for people. You know, I don't mind discussing the fact that I'm a woman that, or that I'm a woman composer and what are the problems with women – and women composers. It's I don't know, maybe I'm just kind of stupid about it or something, but
okay, I just was curious. I mean, I can imagine that there's wide varieties of opinions on that.
There is, and I had a colleague of mine who's a very good friend of mine chew me out because I have this term DWEM, dead white European males. And I use it just like – it's sort of like a joke and sort of like – because some of my favorite composers are DWEMs.
Like Mozart.
No, Beethoven, not okay. Mozart. But and he just chewed me out one day at a seminar. He said, Joan, I wish you would stop using this term. It's a very sensitive term that you're using. And you're – it's like you're criticizing me. I could be a dead white European man. I said, but you're not. You're not dead and you're not European. And it was like we had this whole big discussion. And he actually made me see that it was a term that I took more lightly than – much more lightly than he did. And then I had to be careful. And he was right. He was right.
But you're okay with being a female composer from New York who was born – Go on and on.
I mean, you're stuck with these things. Yeah, okay. You don't have much choice, you know.
You're not going to burn the energy on
you're
it.
Right.
You know, you've written from every possible combination of instruments, but I'm not aware of anything written for the human voice. Is there a reason for that?
Oh, there's a whole history of, it turns out, of composers – you know, who write for the voice very comfortably and have written a lot of operas and a lot of vocal music. And then there are composers who have written a lot of instrumental music and very little vocal music. I wish somebody would do a study of this so I could understand why I have trouble with writing for the voice. I do not understand it, quite frankly. I've tried to rationalize it into, first of all, the mix of words and music is very difficult for me. I can't seem to put those two together. I mean, I love theater, for example. I just adore the theater. But the minute you start to have somebody sing in a dramatic setting, I get very confused. And then, well, singers are always asking me, you know, they said, well, just drop the words. Don't use any words. Just do a vocalese. So then I had another problem with, well, it's the voice. There's something about the voice, and I was a vocal accompanist for many years, and I loved that literature. And it's not that I dislike the voice. It's that when I have to go to write for it, something happens. It's a different mode of expression. I don't know. It's all very psychological. I really don't understand it myself.
Okay. But this is by reason of your own lack of confidence in writing in that area.
Then. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But well, I'm not the only one. There's a whole history.
Yeah, but you're the one we're talking
to. I'd like
to
know why this is happening with some people.
Okay. Well, Joan, why don't we take a break now? I know you brought some of your own music. Do you have any selection we could listen to now?
Yeah, for starters, it might be interesting to hear the fanfare for The Uncommon Woman, number one.
We have just heard the fanfare for The Uncommon Woman, written by our guest today, Joan Tower, performed by the St. Louis Symphony, conducted by Leonard Slatkin. Tell us a little bit about that piece.
Well, the Houston Symphony was celebrating their sesquicentenary or something like that. And they decided to commission a fanfare for each one of their subscription concerts, which I thought was a great idea. And so they called me and asked me to do one of them. So I started thinking about what is a fanfare. I really wasn't sure what – I mean, it just was sort of new to me. And all I kept thinking of was the fanfare for the for the Common Man by Copland. And so I said, well, maybe this is my chance to give a little tribute to Copland. Who I think is a wonderful composer. And so I got the same instrumentation, and there's one little snippet of a tune taken from his piece, and then I wrote my own fanfare. And a friend of mine said, what are you going to call it? And I said, fanfare. She said, that's it? And I said, how about fanfare for the uncommon woman? I just sort of blurted it out as a joke. She said, that's a great title. You should really seriously think about that title. So I started thinking about the program note. You know, there's always the problem of the program note. You know, how does the title match the piece and how does the piece match the program note? And so I started thinking about women who take risks and who are adventurous. And I decided to make this a tribute to them.
There's a little bit of autobiographical stuff in there, though, isn't it?
Well, you know, I need help. I need company. And this past year, I originally didn't dedicate it to any woman in specifically, whereas the others I have dedicated to specific women. I decided to dedicate it to somebody who I admire a lot and who, in fact, is a very uncommon woman. That's the conductor, Marin Alsop.
Who is it, the Colorado Symphony?
Yes, she's now Colorado Symphony.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a nice thing to have an endorsement up there.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
What about the other fanfares? Now, you have five of them?
I have five of them. It just kept going and going. Well, see, the first one got a lot of attention because of the title, not because of the piece, but because of the title. And I said to myself, this is not good. This is not good. If a piece like that gets so much attention because of the title, because it had a lot of political overtones to it, I said, I've got to write a better one. So I wrote a second one, a third one. They've been commissioned by various occasions, like the 100th anniversary of Carnegie Hall, the opening of the Harris Hall in Aspen, the 100th anniversary of Kansas City Symphony, you know, various occasions. I've really learned how to write for brass since then.
Three-minute pieces, right?
Yeah, it's been a real education in writing for brass.
No Bruckner symphonies for you.
No.
Well, that's cool. And all of these are dedicated to different people?
Yes.
Can you?
Sure. The second one is dedicated to Fran Richards, who is the concert director of ASCAP. who's a really phenomenal lady, woman. I hate that word, lady, woman. And the third one is dedicated to The second one is dedicated to Joan Perchetti, who's the former general manager of the St. Louis Symphony, who's an incredible woman. And these are all incredible women. The third one is to Francis Richard, who's head of the concert division at ASCAP. And I'm BMI, incidentally, not ASCAP. Okay. The fourth one is dedicated to Joanne Folletta. Yeah. And the fifth one is dedicated to Joan Harris, who is the wife. There's Joan and Irving Harris, and they dedicated this large amount of money to the Harris Hall in Aspen. And when I wrote the piece, can I tell this story?
You can tell.
Do we have time? Oh, so I wrote this. They asked me to write an opening for the hall and for these two people, and I said I'd like to do another fanfare. So that means it'll only be dedicated to the wife. And they said, fine, that's great. So. There's this big black tie event, you know, and I had to conduct because the four trumpets couldn't stay together because they were at opposite ends of the hall. Anyways, and so this guy comes up to me who's in his 70s and he's practically in tears. It's Irving Harris. And he said, I just want to tell you I am very deeply moved that you have done this for my wife who never gets enough attention. And he was just so moved by this. And I was moved that he was moved, you know. So then I met her. I never had met her. She was this great down-to-earth woman, just full of life and energy and humor and a very real kind of person. I was so happy that she was who she was, you know.
And you captured it well, I hope.
Yeah,
I hope.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. So it was sight unseen.
Yeah, was sight unseen.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Well— can we have a little history? I mean, I know you were born in New York and lived in South America as a child and then went to Bennington and Columbia. But that's about all I know. Can you fill in a few of the blanks?
From what age? what age do you want me to start?
Highlight it. The first 5 years we can skip. Okay.
Well, I grew up in South America, which because my father was a mining engineer and he got a job in Bolivia. And that really changed my life. I spent 9 years there and learned about another culture, and it had a profound effect on my music too, because we went dancing every night. It's a dancing culture, and I'm a pretty good dancer, so what it did was it made me directed me towards the whole importance of rhythm in music. So my music is very rhythmically based, in the sense that the rhythm is what fuels the piece. And I don't mean just beat rhythm, you know, but the whole sense of how does a piece unfold in time, that kind of rhythm. And I developed a love for percussion, too, because they were always throwing me some percussion instrument.
Were you starting into musical training then? I mean,
yeah, I was also being trained as a classical pianist.
In Bolivia.
I studied with Erich von Stroheim's wife, who was this witch from hell. She lived in a haunted house. I was terrified of her.
You will practice.
You will do this tomorrow or I cut your fingers off, you know. Whoops, wrong accent.
Yeah, no.
I
slipped
into
the
Latin accent. You will do this tomorrow. Yes. So I had those two things coming up as I was growing up. The classical Dwem music, dead white European male music. Sorry. And then the Latin rhythm music and the Inca music. So I had those two influences as I was growing up.
So there was a lot of musical nurturing in your family?
Oh, well, my father was very musical. He made sure I had a piano and a teacher wherever we went.
And did he play or sing?
Yeah, he played the violin badly. He sang badly. He played the banjo mandolin better.
You've written no banjo concertos.
No.
Maybe they were figuring out why you don't write for the voice. I don't know.
That's right.
That's it. Must be it.
That's it. Oh, I never thought of that. That's very good. I like that.
So, but all the time they were nurturing this. Is it something that they thought?
They knew I was talented.
No good.
He made a real effort to get me teachers and pianos where it wasn't so easy sometimes.
Well, I would imagine
it. In Bolivia, it was not easy.
But then you moved back to the States?
And then I went to Chile. They put me in a boarding school because I was rather obstreperous. And then I had a year in Lima, Peru, where I mostly rode horses and went to secretarial school because I had a year in between schools and partied. And then I came back to the United States.
Wow.
When I was 17.
And
went to another boarding school.
What are they trying? Never mind. We don't need to get into that.
Right.
But then went on to Bennington.
Yes. Then to Bennington and then to Columbia.
But always pursuing a career or a love of music.
Always.
You were a performer.
That's right. Then I started my own group in New York, the Da Capo Chamber Players. Mm-hmm. I actually started a series in New York and then the Da Capo Chamber Players, which was a quintet of flute, clarinet, violoncello, and piano. And then I became composer in residence with St. Louis. St. Louis in 1986.
Okay, but we got another 13 years.
Oh, okay. You want me to go on? Okay.
Yeah, we're sitting here looking at each other. No, but St. Louis. Can you touch on that? That must have been a fairly important part of your musical career.
Oh, it was a phenomenal. I mean, Leonard Slatkin knew one piece of mine called Sequoia, which he sort of really adopted, and he played it all over the place immediately and recorded it, and then he invited me to be a composer in residence. I was totally flabbergasted by all this, and I wrote him a letter, as a matter of fact, and I said, you know, I've got to tell you that I have one concerto, cello concerto, and one orchestra piece, and that's all I have, and you're taking me on the basis of that? And he said, yeah, you wrote one very good orchestra piece, and we're going to help you write more.
Oh, my gosh. What
now,
a
that's,
gift.
You know, that's a risk level that he's always operating on. You know, he's one of those rare conductors who says to himself, he figures out what he likes about a piece, a new piece, and then he says, I'm going to do this piece. And so he goes there to the orchestra and says, this is it. I'm going to do this piece. And they, you know, there's a lot of resistance. Well, I don't know, you know, the marketing and the blah, blah. But he says, well, if you want me to conduct, then this is part of the program, this piece. And he does it all the time. And it's just and he's willing to stand alone with his opinion of the piece. Sometimes he has a good piece and sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes he's wrong. Sometimes he's right. But he's willing to take that risk, which is something that's missing with a lot of prominent musicians today. They're not always willing to take that risk, which is interesting because they're willing to take risks on all kinds of other levels, but not on the music itself level.
You got to play the tried and true. It's difficult to
I mean, if you play badly or that night or something, at least they're not willing to say, I like this piece and I'm going to see if anybody else likes it too. But I like it enough that I'm going to try it. I'm going to put it out there.
So he gave
That's a risk. That's a risk. Right.
So he gave you an opportunity, though, to work with a major orchestra to write for those kind of instruments.
Oh, yeah. And I it was an incredible learning experience.
I would think so.
Oh, yeah.
And with someone who made it happen.
Yeah.
Do you have other passions besides music that helps fuel, you said dancing, that fuel the music making? You know, some people paint or climb mountains.
Well, I think music is kind of a thing unto itself. It has its own curious landscape. You can paint, you can draw, you can climb mountains, you can do all that. And I used to draw. Actually, I used to draw pictures of the piece I was going to write. But, you know, it's sort of like therapy in a way. It's sort of like preparation. And it's more therapeutic than it is musical. The connections can be made sort of arbitrarily, but I think once you hit the piece of music, you're in another world. You are in the musical world. So, you know, my students write all kinds of things around and they prepare and everything, but I tell them, you know, nothing has happened yet until the music starts.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, the music is like a – once it starts to have its own personality, its own demands, its own domain. You might have had – you might be giving it something from outside. Climbing the mountain, I don't know – this is very complex.
Oh, I know. Maybe we got a little heavy here.
Of course it plays a role, but the problem is that once you go into that room with that piece, it's in its own domain.
Okay. There's nothing else there.
Yeah, right.
You're floating in space, in essence.
Yeah. So,
okay. This has gotten a little heavy. Why don't we take another break?
Oh, okay.
Try to collect what we under what I'm sitting here trying to figure out.
Okay.
So what do you have now that we can listen to?
The next piece is a piece called Wings, and it's for clarinet. And it's my first attempt at trying to choreograph sound. I'm very interested in slow movement here as well as high movement, high and fast, and speed and relationship to location. In other words, is it high and fast, or is it high and slow, or is it low and slow? I call it choreographing sound.
We have just heard Wings, a piece for solo clarinet written by our guest today, Joan Tower. It was played by Laura Flax, and it's on a recording called, you give it to me now.
Chamber and Solo Works.
Chamber and Solo Works on what label?
Composer's Recordings, Inc., CRI.
You were talking before about choreographing sound. Can you sort of, I'm not quite sure I catch it. Can
okay.
you help me?
Okay. I think of music very much like dance, that if you have one dancer in a corner or two or three or four, that's a question of texture and it's a question of location. The same way in music you have chords or you don't have chords and you have a location which is high or low or middle. And then they move directly, diagonally across the stage at certain speeds or they fan out. All those things have to do with in music. They have the same correlation in music. The chords fan out, and they move at a certain speed. So I developed this concept actually through this piece, Wings. This is one of the first ones I really started to put this out with because it explores very slow time in very specific locations, registers, spaces on the instrument. And then it moves at certain speeds with certain reactions. It's like a bird, actually. That's why the title's Wings. This very big bird, like a falcon, flying very, very high, very slowly, and then seeing some fish way down below and doing some very intricate dives to get there. Anyways.
Okay.
That's why it's choreography.
Well, now that you've given me a music education,
yeah.
right here, at least in your, I'm not sure I catch it all, but
okay.
we'll work at it. You teach music at Bard College. Mm-hmm. What do you think of the standard of music education in the U.S. today, and do you have any thoughts on it?
When I got the Grawemeyer Award, one of the other recipients was Howard Gardner, who is a very big influence in education and educational philosophy. And he has a book out called Frames of Mind, which he thinks there are seven intelligences, and one of them is music. He said this at the press conference. My eyes just dropped. He he feels that if the schools could deal with those seven intelligences as part of the curriculum, we'd have a much better all-around education. And he has actually several schools that actually implement his philosophy now. And the educational system, which moves very slowly, I think looks at these schools to see what's going to happen with them. And I think if music could be thought of as math, as part of the regular disciplined curriculum, we'd have a very different musical society, obviously.
Do you find it tough getting students nowadays or people interested in music?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of interest in music. The question is, what type of music? I think classical music has been having a hard time because it's not in the curriculum at all, or very little. It's not there. So there's no experience with it growing up. But there's a tremendous amount of experience with pop music growing up because it's all over the place. It's on the radio. It's still all over the place. So it's unfair in a way to say, well, classical music is dying. Well, things that are not around tend to die. It's like me going to a publishing store, which I did in New York, and I said, do you have such and such a piece? And they said, no, it doesn't sell. And I said, well, how can it sell if you don't have it?
If you have the opportunity just to compose for yourself without a commission or anything else, is there any specific medium that you use, or solo instruments, quartets, whatever it might be?
Well, now that my time is running out, I have been actually thinking about this, because now that I'm elderly.
Wait a minute, we're the same age. Let's don't do that.
No, it's funny how you start thinking about time, you know. I want to write a percussion piece before I leave, a percussion piece. I want to write another string quartet because I love that world. I think the string quartet is a very special world. And I want to write more piano music, which I will be doing, because I've sort of avoided that all my life. And I am a pianist, you know, so. And then maybe one more orchestra piece, no more than that.
How do you discipline yourself?
I'm extraordinarily disciplined. If once I start writing a piece, I'm home. You know, I compose from 1 to 6, 5 hours, and I will kill to get home on time. There's nothing that will stop me, you know.
Okay.
It's like a schedule. It's like going to work. You have to be there at a certain time. The time is very important to me, that I have those 5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
For musical reasons, not for milk and magnesia reasons.
and you have a controlled environment there, so you can make your own.
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
So you get used to it and know how to use the space.
Yeah.
Why don't we hear one more piece?
Okay.
And then I think I'll have one, and we'll have to finish up. So what do we have here?
This is a piece I wrote in 1980 called Petrush Gates. It's 5 minutes long. It's an homage to Stravinsky and particularly his Petrushka. And this is like a carnival on ice, and it features my group that I used to play with, the DeCapo Chamber Players.
So let's hear it.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in October of 1998. Production assistance came from Michael Paskash and Christina Kuzmich. For WFIU, thanks for listening.